It's almost a year since US troops began withdrawing from Afghanistan, marking the end of a two-decade war that ended with almost total capitulation to the Taliban. It was a chaotic evacuation that saw thousands of Afghan civilians desperately trying to get aboard flights out of the country. You'll remember the scenes. And jubilant Taliban soldiers taking over Kabul airport within hours of the last flight out. Why did the war end in such an unmitigated failure? And why were the United States and its coalition partners unable to defeat the Taliban in Afghanistan? What lessons can and should be learned from it? Our guest is David Kilcullen, the Australian counterinsurgency expert, formerly with the US State Department as senior counterinsurgency advisor to the then US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He was also counterinsurgency advisor to the International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, in Afghanistan, the NATO-led security mission in Afghanistan, established by the UN in 2001. Its main purpose was to train the Afghan forces and assist in rebuilding government institutions. His latest book is co-written with Greg Mills and entitled The Ledger, Accounting for Failure in Afghanistan. David's with us from Denver, Colorado. Welcome back, David. We've spoken before. Really appreciate you now. You've given this full analysis being available again. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's great to be back on.
I think last time we talked about a key missed moment, if there was one during this war, was 2012 and the surge. But now we are reflecting on 20 years and what was an humiliating exit by the US. Can you speak first to that moment in time, that chaotic withdrawal from Kabul in August 2021? You and Greg Mills were working to help to secure the safety of a number of vulnerable Afghans. Can you tell us a little of those days and how they unfolded?
Yeah, well, it was absolute chaos, as I think people remember. After confidently assuring everybody that the Taliban were not likely to come anywhere near Kabul, you know, within a year, we saw the collapse of, you know, 16 out of the 34 provinces in about 2 days, and all of the rest, bar one, in another week. So with the first half of August, the war sort of seemed to accelerate suddenly, and it very much caught the US government in particular by surprise, or perhaps even you could say they were in denial about how rapidly it was proceeding. And it didn't just lead to the abandonment of the Afghans, it also led to, frankly, the abandonment of the other 53 countries that had committed to the effort to support the United States, including New Zealand and Australia. So it was a fiasco. There's no really easy way to describe it. Greg and I spent multiple days, probably 4 or 5 days without any sleep, and then another week snatches of sleep, working with our teams on the ground and people in the airport and in the city to evacuate vulnerable Afghans. Many of them made it, the folks we worked with, not all. There are still tens of thousands of people vulnerable and left behind in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, there's no prospect, I think, that the international community is going to take their plight seriously because of all the other things that are going on right now. So, you know, I think it was a moral catastrophe as well as a humiliating defeat. It was likened by some people to the withdrawal from Vietnam in 1975. But as Greg and I point out in the book, that comparison is actually unfair to Vietnam, which was conducted much better and in a much more orderly fashion than what happened in Kabul.
Was it a failure of intelligence, or should the peace deal simply not have been signed? And just as a little aside, we spoke a little earlier this week to filmmaker and writer Fazila Amiri, who was in Afghanistan at the time, back in Afghanistan, her place of birth at the time, documenting some women in that country's equivalent of American Idol. And it turned into, the backdrop became, and it turned into this catastrophic collapse and the advance of the Taliban as quickly as it advanced and the end of their hopes and dreams. So her point was there should never have been a peace deal signed with the Taliban. What is your take?
I agree with that. And, you know, I've noticed in the US that people on the right of politics have tried to blame this on President Biden, and people on the left of politics have tried to blame it on Trump. In fact, it's a bipartisan screw-up that goes back over both parties and, frankly, four presidential administrations back to George W. Bush, but certainly President Trump's decision to sign the deal in 2020 with the Taliban, which then led to the Taliban basically encroaching and getting into pole position around every provincial capital and many of the district centers by the beginning of 2021, left the Biden administration in a position where they really needed to recognize the extraordinarily severe threat to the Afghan government and do something about it. For political reasons, they chose not to do that and chose to pretend instead that everything was going to be fine. And as a result, when the Taliban did begin to move around April of 2021, the districts and then the provincial centers rapidly began to fall. So I think it was an intelligence failure, but in common with many intelligence failures, it wasn't so much that the intelligence collectors didn't understand what was going on. It was that the decision makers either didn't understand or willfully ignored a lot of the material that was coming forward to them, and then were just positioned really badly to react when things spun out of control.
Nation after nation has invaded and failed in Afghanistan. The primary reason for that invasion in 2001 was in response to the Twin Towers attack and the sources of where the instigators of that attack might be. In that context, was there ever a time to make peace or to bring the Taliban into the tent and to exit?
Absolutely. And we talk about this in some detail in the book. And that time was approximately 7 weeks into the 20-year war. It was the night of the 7th of December 2001 when the last Taliban stronghold in Kandahar fell. And most people that weren't there at the time don't know this, but the Taliban actually surrendered, acknowledged the authority of the incoming government under Hamid Karzai, asked for a peace deal, and promised not to engage in violence against the government as long as they could return safely to their houses. And we, myself and Greg, lived this, and we recall it in the book. What happened was that President Karzai said, yes, that's a great idea. We should make peace and bring them back into the tent and engage in reconciliation. And Donald Rumsfeld, who was the US Secretary of Defense at the time, said, no, we don't talk to terrorists. And the US essentially shut that initiative down before it even started. And so we did have the opportunity to make peace early. There wasn't, in fact, a major insurgency in Afghanistan at all until the early part of 2004. So even having made that mistake in 2001, we still had a couple of years of opportunity in which to, you know, actually engage in a serious reconciliation effort, which we never did. We simply took it for granted that once we'd defeated the Taliban, they somehow ceased to exist, as if they didn't need to be taken into account going forward. And I describe this in the book, and Greg agrees, as the master era, right? The era that from which everything else flowed, that we didn't take any steps towards reconciliation when we had the chance.
Beyond that, over these 20 years, what could have been a different result? And I'm thinking here of people like Fasila and others who wanted a different life. They want education. They want to be able to sing and perform and make music. They want to be journalists. Is that the responsibility of other nations? And was there ever an opportunity over these two decades to secure that? Or was the Taliban always just going to wait?
So couple of thoughts on that. One, I do think there was an opportunity, and frankly, there still is an opportunity, and people need to know, and it isn't widely reported, but there are significant movements against the Taliban in many major cities in Afghanistan. The National Resistance Front, otherwise known as the actual government of Afghanistan, is fighting back against the Taliban and has recaptured significant areas of territory. And the same people, the same women that want education, the same urban populations that want an opportunity to participate in the global economy, they're all pushing very, very hard back at the Taliban. The Taliban don't actually have the manpower to secure the cities and also keep control of the rest of the country, and they're already struggling, and we're already starting to see Taliban leaders switch sides because they realize that the Taliban government isn't strong enough to hold. So I think it's not dead, but unfortunately, as you rightly point out, the international community is offering no support right now. I do think there was a time at which we could have achieved it. And it relates to the last conversation that you and I had a while ago about the waste of the surge, where we surged into Afghanistan but simultaneously told the Taliban exactly when we were going to leave, which then set up that dynamic that you talked about where they just waited us out. But even at their strongest, they've never been supported by more than 5 to 10% of the Afghan population. And in the urban areas, it's even less. So I think long-term, the problem is not that the Taliban are strong and Afghanistan's weak. It's that the Taliban are also weak, right? It's a problem of chaos and instability going forward.
What do you see when you look into your crystal ball in the region?
Well, it's ironic because one of the things that President Biden said when he essentially telegraphed that he was planning to let the Taliban take over in July of 2021 was we are pulling out of Afghanistan in order to better focus on competing with China. That was the excuse or the pretext that was given by the US government at the time. And ironically, the big winner here is actually China, right? So now you have China's major regional ally, Pakistan, very much calling the shots with the leaders of the Taliban in Kabul. You've got China still having an open embassy in Kabul, owning some of the most important mineral deposits and other economic assets in the country. And essentially, over time, you may start to see Afghanistan coming increasingly into the Chinese orbit, which matters in particular because China now has a deal with Iran that allows it to import oil and engage in shared free trade and military alliance across that same area of South Asia. So really the big beneficiary here is China. And I think long-term, when we look at what's going on in Ukraine and we look at the risk of conflict over places like Taiwan, one of the big second-order effects of this is the perception by people of Western disunity, Western weakness, and in particular just incompetence and sheer inability to cope on the part of the US government. And I think that, you know, Vladimir Putin being emboldened to invade Ukraine had something to do with the perception that you could get away with it because of what just happened in Afghanistan.
Thank you. David Kilcullen has co-authored with Greg Mills, The Ledger, Accounting for Failure in Afghanistan.